Okay, so welcome everyone to the June 30th, 2021 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference. Let's see, we'll take the roll here first. So so far I see on the list we have Sheila Casey, Richard Gage, Peter Ketchum, Paul Zaremka, Pat O'Connell, Marty Hopper, Lynn Cornelison, Kathy Allard, Carl Gullivan, John Olson, Frank Tolupko, Vern Tishman, David Cole, Sherry Jacobs, Ann Hendricks, Elias Davidson, and myself. And we're waiting for Greg and Barry. Okay. And while we're waiting, why don't we approve the minutes and the agenda? So are there any objections to the minutes as written and sent out? And thank you to Anne for doing so. Hearing no objections, the minutes are passed, approved. Okay, and then the agenda, are there any objections to changing to, well, let's, I guess, what do we have to do? Accept the agenda as it is first, and then we can make changes if we need to. So are there any objections to the agenda as written and posted? Okay, hearing none, the minute the agenda is approved. And then are there any objections to switching the order of our speakers in the event that Mark Crispin Miller doesn't join us when we're ready to start?
Makes good sense.
Okay, great. So hearing no objections. Oh, hello?
I'm trying to figure out whether Barry's still with me. I tried to – are you there, Barry? Okay, it's something I did something wrong. Why don't we, Cheryl? Do you want to go ahead and
do the roll, and then we've approved the minutes and the agenda, and so we'll get started. You just join us. Does that sound all right?
Yes. Oh, you did the roll already?
Yes. Yep.
Oh, you did. Okay. Okay. Great.
Yeah.
So I'll let you go ahead, and I'll see if I can get Barry hooked in.
Hey, Craig, do you want me to try to hook in Barry? I'm on a landline. That might work easier.
If you know what you're doing.
Do you want to just send me his phone number on Facebook or text me or something with his number rather than giving it out to everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll do that.
And I'll just tell Barry I'll hang up here. I'll call Barry and then I'll call back in.
Okay, perfect.
That's how my three-way calling works.
Okay, great.
But I'll just wait till I get that number from you. How are you going to send it?
What's that?
How are you going to send it? Do you want to text me?
Yes. Which number? I mean, give me the beginning of the right number to. Oh, I don't want to. I can't text your landline, right?
Right. You could do 703-996. That's how it starts.
Okay. I'll text it to you.
Okay. Thanks.
Great. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, great. So while they're doing that, we'll get started. I'll see Mark with us, so I will look for him once Elias is starting with his thing. I'm sorry about this book. This happens sometimes. And, okay, so Elias, thank you for being willing to go first. Thank you for joining us at this late hour in Germany. I think it's 3 a.m. there. So Ann Hendricks will introduce our first guest, Elias. So Ann, if you would please do that.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks, Elias, for getting up at 2 in the morning over there in Germany. We appreciate it. Elias was born in Palestine in 1941 to German Jewish parents and was raised in Jerusalem. He settled in Iceland in 1962, where he lived for 40 years. He's now retired and in Germany. He had two careers, first as a computer expert and later as a music teacher and composer. Prior to becoming a researcher on 9/11 and false flag terrorism, he was involved in human rights work and international law. He is the author of 6 books in English and German covering 4 major terrorist attacks, including 9/11, London, Mumbai, and Berlin. The 2 9/11 books are Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, Counterfeiting Evidence, and the other one was published last summer, America's Betrayal Confirmed, 9/11 Purpose, Cover-Up, and Impunity. Thank you, Elias, for joining us.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Elias, if I can just jump in before you start, I'm going to put everybody in lecture mode and then unmute you. So if you just hang on a second. And okay, now Elias, you are unmuted. And just so that you know, Elias will be speaking for 30 minutes, and I will give you a 5 minute when you have 5 minutes left. I'll let you know. All right, so go ahead, Elias. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. I'm very honored by this invitation. I'd like to speak today because the audience is all veteran 9/11 truthers. So I am not going to revise to talk very much about 9/11 on the details, but I will try to divide my presentation into three sections. First, I will provide a summary presentation of my new book on 9/11. I think it is important to do that, and you will understand why. Second part will be, I will mention 10 aspects of 9/11 that, in my opinion, have been neglected by our movement. And in the last part of the presentation, I will try to compare the psychological aspects of Operation 9/11 with those of Operation Corona. Well, first of all, let me explain why I wrote a book last year, published a new book on 9/11. We have had so many books on 9/11, very, very fine books, but I was thinking that I did not really find and discover a book which in a compact way will take upon basically all aspects of 9/11 in a rounded but compact and thorough way. And so I wrote that book, and if somebody has written something similar, I would be very pleased, because in science, the more people who are doing independent work on the same subject, the better the subject is discussed. And if somebody has written something similar, my book will just corroborate and support the other book. In any case, the book which I published last year, it's called America's Betrayal Confirmed. It is my third and will probably be remained my last book on 9/11. The foreword was written by a former minister of the research and technology in Germany, who was also a member of the committee overseeing intelligence services. It was Dr. Andreas von Bülow, who some of the 9/11 truthers may even remember. So he wrote this foreword. The argument of the book is nothing novel. It is that the U.S. government must be regarded as the main suspect for the mass murder of 9/11. The argument is, of course, nothing new, but the book presents four unique and useful features that make it, in fact, a welcome entry into this crowd. I will now explain what are the unique features of that book. First of all, the book provides a thorough but compact treatment of each major aspect of 9/11. Each factual statement is backed up by mainstream and official sources comprising altogether almost 1,000 footnotes. Second, the book is designed to become a reference handbook on 9/11 that can be used and cited not only by 9/11 truthers, but also by mainstream journalists, researchers, librarians, and teachers. I don't know of other books who provide such a wealth of evidence on 9/11 in such a compact and accessible form. Third, this book is conceived, and this is important, it is conceived in a modular way. This modular structure means that each chapter represents an independent indictment of the official account. This architecture provides unusual strength to the main argument of the book, because anyone attempting to challenge that main argument would have to debunk every chapter separately. And the fourth unique feature is that it represents a transparent scholarship. By this I mean that readers are provided a direct access to virtually all original research documents, all the source documents. They can thereby easily verify the accuracy and credibility of each factual statement in the book. This approach corresponds, in my view, with science as it should be. It means a collective and transparent effort. This transparency means that I'm putting myself basically exposed to the regards of the readers. Each reader can find out whether each statement is true and well backed up. And this method has been used in all my books. The result has been that not a single person has ever mentioned to me false facts in my books. I consider that a very strong support of this work. There is also a small bonus in this book for veteran 9/11 truthers. There are many scoops in that book, facts that have not been published before. One of these is the real reason why the bags of Mohammed Atta were not loaded onto flight American Airlines 11. Note that we don't have a clue who this American Atta was. He was certainly not the withdrawn architecture student from Hamburg. But I discovered in some kind of document from the 9/11 Commission why these baggages were left in Boston. And this is explained in the book. The book is, by the way, available both in print format and e-book, and you can find links to the book on the internet. So, that's it about my book. Let me now go to the 10 aspects which I consider have been neglected by the 9/11 truth movement. And this is not in order to lambast or to criticize anybody, but I think that these items have been neglected for various reasons which I'm not going to go into. Okay, the first one is that the entire 9/11 legend rests on one and only one claim, namely that 19 Islamic terrorists hijacked planes on 9/11. Let me make it abundantly clear that there exists not a shred of evidence for this allegation. Zero. Absolutely nothing. This is perhaps the most fundamental truth on 9/11. And this fact alone demolishes in one go the entire official narrative as a house of cards. This fact has enormous international implications, which I will come to later. The second item is the phone calls. The phone calls allegedly made from the planes have served to sell the official hijacking narrative. But what did the callers say? In my first book on 9/11, Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, published in 2013, I enclosed a comprehensive analysis of the more than 50 phone calls documented by the FBI. What this analysis shows is that no real hijackings took place, but the callers were participating, very likely, in simulated hijacking exercises in conjunction with the military drills. Anyone still believing that somebody hijacked planes on 9/11 is invited to read the 150 pages that I devoted to these phone calls. Third, the FBI has formally admitted to a civilian court, in conjunction with a suit brought against the FBI by Aidan Monaghan, that it did not even attempt to link the debris from the several crash sites to any particular aircraft. This means that there exists no formal evidence by the U.S. government that any passenger aircraft had crashed on 9/11. Those who maintain that American Airlines 77 crashed on the Pentagon should take notice of this fact. Fourth, the Twin Towers in New York did not actually collapse. They rather were transformed into dust clouds. As a result, about 1,100 people vanished literally into thin air without leaving any evidence of their existence. New Yorkers were then expected to breathe particles of human flesh. This is perhaps one of the most sinister aspects of 9/11, which even the architects and engineers for 9/11 have not discussed very much. Fifth, a further neglected aspect is a massive bribery enacted by the U.S. Congress to prevent questions to be asked. I'm not only talking about the unprecedented amounts lavished on victims' families in order to keep them quiet, but also on victims' families in order to keep them quiet, but also about how politicians cynically played on these people's vanity by pampering and celebrating them. The level of perversity displayed by Compensation Fund Chief Feinberg and Judge Alberstein of New York verges on the criminal. Sixth, how many have noticed of the bombing scares staged in many cities around the United States following 9/11 in order to amplify the traumatic effects of the events? In fact, such a campaign of bombing scares connected to 9/11 extended to many parts of the world. There is no doubt in my mind that this campaign of bombings was run by the same actors who planned 9/11. Seventh, an internationally significant event took place on September 12th. Around noon on that day, the UN Security Council determined, without obtaining or requesting any evidence, that, one, the United States had been attacked from outside its borders, and two, gave the U.S. government a green light to attack any country of its choosing as a response. The Council thereby gave the U.S. the permission to commit the crime of aggression, the supreme international crime. The U.S. used this permission to bomb the poorest country of the world, Afghanistan, which had nothing to do with 9/11. This historical decision by the Security Council suggests that the Permanent Council of the Security Councils were privy to the preparation of 9/11 and agreed beforehand to promote the official account. Indeed, none of these states has ever challenged the official account of 9/11. Let us remember this fact as one of the first steps on the road to a world government. Eight, certain tasks relative to the preparation of 9/11 were outsourced by the U.S. government to Saudi Arabia, Israel, Pakistan, and Germany. Saudi Arabia furnished the hijacking patsies. Israel furnished the five dancing Israelis. Pakistan had people sending money to the American ATA. And Germany helped build the legend of the Hamburg terrorist cell. Ninth, let us hammer the fact that the U.S. government and its agencies never formally accused Osama bin Laden for 9/11. They did not even attempt to justify by him the war against Afghanistan. In the letter that the U.S. sent to the Security Council describing their war on Afghanistan, they do not even mention any responsibility of Afghanistan or Osama bin Laden. It is historically important to understand how bin Laden was built up by Western media as an icon between 1998 and 2001 in order to serve as a whipping boy on the day. And tenth, and this is really a surprise surely for most of you, Osama bin Laden may in fact qualify to the title of the first 9/11 truther. If you don't believe it, read what he said to a Pakistan newspaper just 2 weeks after 9/11. And let me just quote what he said. First of all, he said that he was not responsible in any way for 9/11. Second, he emphasized that 9/11, that the attacks of 9/11 were against the principles of Islam, because killing innocent people is not compatible with the Islamic ethics. And what he said in addition is that the American people should look for the perpetrators among themselves. He said that in an interview with the Pakistani newspaper Ummat, which appears in Karachi on 28th of September 2001. And this interview appears in the compendium of Bin Laden writings issued by the CIA. I got, in fact, the original interview from Karachi. So this is a very credible source. Now, let me finally draw your attention to the similarities between 9/11 and the Corona campaign. First of all, both campaigns were prepared over years, including by simulations. This is probably known to everybody. Secondly, both campaigns were at the same time, of the time of the launching, the largest propaganda operations in human history. And third, both campaigns were designed to help politicians to justify mass surveillance, increase executive power, empower the police, and reduce the independence of the justice system. There exists, nevertheless, one crucial difference between the two campaigns. The 9/11 propaganda only attempted to affect people's attitudes to terrorism, only their mind. It did not intend to affect people's daily behavior. People continued after 9/11 running their daily lives as before, and the fear from terrorism faded with time, particularly as no terrorists were visible around. The Corona propaganda campaign went a major step further. It did not only target people's attitudes, but was accompanied by government measures that forced people to radically change their normal behavior. The combination of propaganda and compulsion seen since last year constitutes the largest Pavlovian experiment ever conducted. If you want to change people's attitudes, make them change their behavior. Attitude change will follow. It has long been scientifically demonstrated that people tend to adapt their attitudes to conform with their conduct in order to avoid cognitive dissonance. After a while, people even tend to justify their newly acquired conduct and might resist to return to their former conduct. Keeping distance from other people or wearing a mask might end by remaining a social norm, even when not required by law. I think that the challenge for us in the 9/11 Truth Movement is enormous. We need in our advocacy to go far beyond the forensic of the crime. We need to help people connect the dots. This requires that we ourselves understand how the diverse social and political events and measures interrelate and are driven by common actors, namely those who have the resources and intent to rule over the world's population. In our advocacy, we should focus on those groups of the population who might be receptive to our messages. In the case of 9/11, for example, Arabs and Muslims, and those who are the people who are most to gain from exposing the 9/11 lies. They should become the 9/11 Truth Movement's strongest allies. We also need to engage with other movements that attempt to combat injustice, such as the peace movement, the human rights movement, those who resist the creeping digital dictatorship, those who oppose the world government and social injustice, and those, of course, who oppose the corona measures. We must show willingness and humility to learn also from these groups whose dedication to their own cause may be as strong as ours. I think that such synergies will help us both on the question of 9/11 and also to stop the destruction of human civilization. Thank you very much for listening. Hello.
Yeah, Elias, I think Cheryl's probably...
Okay, yes.
You have to unmute everybody so that, yeah, we can... You're not alone on the line.
Yes, you hear?
Cheryl, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, wonderful presentation. Thank you very much for connecting 9/11 to the whole corona matter.
This is Cheryl. Sorry, I couldn't unmute myself. It just wouldn't work there for a moment. So anyway, everyone right now is unmuted, and we're going to take a Q&A for Elias, and thank you, Elias, for that nice presentation. And before we do, while you're deciding if you want to get in the queue, it's *6. I'll put it in that in a moment. But we have someone join us who's under anonymous. Is there someone who joined us in the beginning of Elias's presentation?
That's probably Sheila again, because she had to call back in because she was conferencing in with Barry Zwicker.
Okay. Oh, okay. All right. So I was hoping. All right. That's good. Okay, so great. Let me just put it in Q&A mode, and then if you'd like to ask a question of Elias. And while people are getting in the queue, again, it's *6. Elias, I have your book, and I'm only in the first few pages, but I really like it. I like the format and everything that you've chosen. And I find it really helpful to review 9/11 since I haven't read a book about it probably in a couple of years. So thank you for writing that, and I'm also going to get your book on Mumbai because I'm curious to learn more about that. And let me just make sure you're unmuted. No, you're not. Okay. Okay, Elias, I just unmuted you if you were trying to speak. Sorry. Okay, so we have a few people in the queue. First one is Sherry Jacobs. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, this is Sherry in San Diego. I just wanted to thank you very much for all of your efforts and for such a wonderful presentation. And I've got your book and sent it to me. And that's all. I just wanted to say thank you.
Okay, Sherry, thank you. And next is Carl Golovin. Carl, go ahead.
Elias, hi. Thank you for your presentation. My question for you goes as to the broader geopolitical context and who were the ultimate beneficiaries of 9/11. I know you said, U.S. government was responsible, but yeah, I would ask, well, who really controls the U.S. government? At that time, domestically, I would say, quote, especially the neocons or neoconservatives who generally are aligned with Israel. And I would point to a couple of books in reference. One, The Controversy of Zion by Doug, and also a new book by Laurent Guyonneau titled Unspoken Kennedy Truth. And even going back to JFK's assassination, at the time Israel was trying to create a nuclear weapon through the Dimona Project and also trying to fight JFK's efforts to force Israeli interests to register as foreign agents of the U.S., would you agree that Israel has been the ultimate beneficiary of 9/11 and that the last 20 years, we've arguably been softening up all the potential adversaries of Israel in proximity to Israel, yeah, making war on Islam, essentially?
My answer is very simple. My answer is no. Israel was no means the main beneficiary of 9/11. There is no evidence for that. The oppression of the Palestinian people has continued exactly the same way. Israel has continued its normal operations, selling weapons all over the world, and so forth and so on. There has been no visible change in Israeli economy or political stance from before 9/11 to today.
Okay, going back historically, as far as expertise in false flag terrorism, I would point towards terrorism conducted on British interests, as well as I think there was a former UN ambassador who was assassinated by, I think it's the Irgun it's pronounced, but also, of course, the USS Liberty incident of 1967, which the book I referenced by Guyano makes it very clear that Lyndon Johnson evidently was quite well in coordination with Israel just as they were about to launch a six-day war, and apparently had foreknowledge of the attack that was going to happen on the Liberty, all of which, you know, is just circumstantial as to, you know, potential, not just participation, but being a beneficiary of 9/11. We have obviously been making war in all the countries around Israel, with Iran being the only remaining target that's really been left untouched.
Let me make it clear. I don't want here to begin a half an hour discussion about the Zionism in Israel. I have been opposed to Zionism since I was 90 years old. I've been writing very many things against the State of Israel. I don't even recognize it personally as a legitimate state. However, I think it is a great mistake to focus on Israel as if Israel was running the world. Israel looks for itself. It has good relations with Russia, with China. It sells weapons to India. It looks for itself, and it is basically, it served the American Empire. It has it was created by the British Empire in 1917, and then it went on to serve the American Empire. And the Liberty story, Israel basically did a dirty job for President Johnson. This was demonstrated by Peter Hunam in his book about this operation. President Johnson asked Israel to sink that ship for U.S. interests. So I invite people to see Israel rather as the 51st State of the Union and not as a central of command.
Okay, thank you. And just for further reference, I think in Deuteronomy, in the Bible, that the mandate is that if the people, the chosen people, will keep themselves separate from all other nations and not assimilate, that God will raise them up to govern over all the world. And that seems to be the Zionist objective, Talmudic Zionist objective, as Douglas Reed describes in The Controversy of Zion, very well documented. And I don't mean to try to engage you in a longer conversation, but I thank you for your perspective.
Yeah, just one little thing. I'm Jewish. I was brought up in Jewish home. I made my bar mitzvah, and I will tell everybody on this conference. I never heard about the chosen people when I was a child and a young person. In my home and in family, never mentioned that. I learned that about the Jewish people when I was an organist in a Christian church in Iceland. It's the first time I heard that the Jewish people have been chosen by anybody. It was a Christian. The Christians who peddled that story to me, I never heard it before. So I'm sorry, this is what my experience is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Carl. And next we have Sheila Casey. Sheila, go ahead.
Yeah, I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to thank you for making the connection between the propaganda campaign to convince us that Muslims did 9/11 and the propaganda campaign regarding COVIDiocy, or the scamdemic. I agree with you that these are the two largest worldwide propaganda campaigns we've ever seen, and I really appreciate you making the connection there.
Well, thank you, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Sheila. And then we have Ian Hendricks. Ian, go ahead.
Hi, Elias, can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Hi, this is Anne. So, yeah, I agree with you that, of course, Arabs and Muslims are certainly our best allies, or should be. And also, victim family members who do not know the truth yet. Anyway, I have two questions for you. I want to know, you have been to Pakistan and met so many, and I think that you could give us a perspective on how the people there, in the Middle East, but Pakistan or in that area, think about the truth of 9/11, and do they contact their relatives, their connections in the U.S., because that certainly would be one way to get the word out, since, I mean, you know, if Pakistanis or Iraqis or whomever can contact the U.S., their connections, that would help. And if they could join the movement, that would be one thing. So I'd like your perspective on their feelings, their sentiment. And the other question is, why do you think Afghanistan was invaded beside the supposed pursuit of bin Laden? Do you have an understanding of why the U.S., is there other reasons that the U.S. went there? That's all.
Okay. The first question, I will tell you, most Arabs or Muslims, which I know, they feel, they have already felt a gut feeling that 9/11 was an inside job. They had a feeling from the first moment that it was. However, in most Arab countries, people are afraid to speak up because the Arab leaders are supporting the United States and supporting the West. So it is not very... People will tell you privately that they know it, the Americans did it, but governments will not do anything about it. And it will be difficult also to publish anything in these countries. And I think that the people in these countries have other problems in their head than to fight about 9/11 or support the Americans. Mm-hmm. They are fighting basically ruthless regimes at home, and they are involved in the wars against Syria, Yemen, and so on. So I've been watching Al Jazeera from time to time, and Al Jazeera is not at all concentrated on 9/11 or false flag. It is basically concentrated on all the different issues which affect the Muslim world. Now, you are asking about Pakistan. In Pakistan, people are even less involved about these problems. They are not interested. Pakistan has now a government which tries to forge a cooperation with China, and people there are very much concerned about the situation in Kashmir, but they are not very much concerned about 9/11 or the United States. So I don't think that Americans can expect any activism from that way. American Muslims and Arabs should speak up themselves. As the second question you posed, the second question was...
Why do you think the U.S. invaded Afghanistan besides the pursuit
The reason Afghanistan was attacked had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. This was just for the people in America, you know, they had to... Osama bin Laden was basically built up by the media in order to serve as a poster boy for 9/11 and serve the attacks on Afghanistan. Afghanistan, I can only conjecture about the reasons for attacking Afghanistan, but I have three reasons which I think might have been. First reason is to put an American base or American military bases in Central Asia, in a cross point between China, Russia, Iran, and Pakistan. This is basically a very strategic point, as was formulated by Zbigniew Brzezinski. He said that whoever controls Central Asia controls the entire the Asia and Europe. This was one reason. Second, the reason was that the U.S. wanted to get hold of the drug trade because the Taliban stopped the drug, the plantation of drugs, and this was basically a big blow to the banks because banks got a lot, enormous cash flow through the drug trade. The cash flow was a very, very big boon to all the banks as reserves. So to get hold of the drug trade, it was necessary to remove the Taliban. And a third reason, which I cannot put my finger on, but it might also be, there are raw materials, very much raw materials in Afghanistan that probably the American corporation would like to have. So a fourth reason would be the pipeline, which was conceived before. But all of these reasons are conjecture of mine. I cannot prove any of them.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you. Can I sneak in one last point?
Sure,
question?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, yep.
So many people today don't want to hear about 9/11 because they say, well, it was 20 years ago, so what? But would you say that since we had a coup, that basically we have been, one of the reasons that it's important to think about it is that we have an illegitimate government because we certainly had a coup at that time.
Are you asking?
I'm asking if, would you say that that would be correct, statement,
yes,
that we have
course,
a legitimate government because they are treasonous and all the following administrations have know the truth and continue in complicity?
Well, of course, the U.S. government is a criminal organization. It had no legitimacy in moral. So I consider the United States a criminal organization already before 9/11. So there is no question in my mind about that. How to get rid of that organization, this is another question. However, I think that 9/11 has a certain importance, and it has an important international dimension. What I mean here is that the Security Council of the United Nations, which is basically operating today like a future world government, has declared international terrorism as one of the biggest threats to peace and security. Now, this is a lie, a complete lie, but this lie is based on 9/11. So all the other terrorist attacks which were imputed to Islamic terrorists, well, maybe not all, but probably most of them, have been conducted under the same template as 9/11. It means they were state operations. So we have a continued thread from 9/11 until today by the Security Council to maintain the fiction of international terrorism and create bodies and create law and impose on all the countries of the world various measures to combat this fiction. And this goes parallel with the Corona fiction. So I think that both Corona and the fiction of terrorist threat are two parts of an agenda to create a world government. And this government is already half constructed. The political side is the Security Council. The financial side is the International Monetary Fund. And the health is the World Health Organization. And all of these institutions are now cooperating with the digital industrial complex, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. So we are, in fact, I think that it is important to keep in mind the role of the Security Council and indirectly of the United Nations as an evolving enemy of humankind. And so we are today in a situation where all governments are cooperating against all the humanity. This is a completely new situation which has never been existing in history, that all governments are basically joining hands to fight the people.
Okay, Anne, you all set?
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. Next we have Paul Zaremka. Paul, go ahead.
Hi, Elias. It's Paul Zaremka.
Hello.
Yes, long time no talk to. Of course, I really enjoyed your first book on 9/11. I have some serious questions about your presentation. First of all, I have not been vaccinated. I don't intend to get vaccinated. I'm promoting something called ivermectin as a prophylactic against COVID-19. But COVID-19 is very serious. I mean, it does kill people. My brother and my sister-in-law living in Kenya, who had no protections at all, died of 3 months ago of COVID. So if for no other reason, I take COVID very seriously. And I've been looking for months now at the medical evidence, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about what you know medically about 9/11 to be able to make statements about, for example, whether we should be wearing mask or not wearing mask. And I would call your attention to the fact that masks in China and Japan are very common as normal practice, particularly in the winter months. People are not embarrassed at all about wearing masks. It's just simply not a big deal. And I think this concerns about mask wearing here partly is a Western conceit. But so anyway, that's one question I have. The other question is a completely different question, and that is you refer to world government, but then you refer to the United States as being solely responsible or almost solely responsible for 9/11, which I can accept. However, if you want to say that this whole thing is moving toward a world government, then you have to go in either two directions. It's going to be a U.S. world government, or it's going to be a world government in which the United States is no more important than anybody else. So I'd like to know your perspective on that. In other words, what's the difference or distinction between world government and U.S. current government?
Okay, let me first dispose of the first question. I'm not a medical expert. When I see the propaganda surrounding COVID-19 and all the changes in the propaganda just to keep the people in fear, it reminds me very much of the propaganda around 9/11 about an invisible enemy. The virus also is an invisible enemy. I don't know of what reason people are dying. I am not a pathologist who did an autopsy of these people. And I am quite aware that there is a lot of fiddling around the figures. But I also know that there are many experts, extremely good experts, who have said and clearly said that all these measures absolutely are not proportional. They are that the COVID is basically like a flu, like maybe a difficult flu, but nothing compared to what it is told, we are told about. And because of the propaganda of the propaganda, I'm extremely wary of what the official experts are telling us. So that is why my answer about COVID. I don't deny that people may die from flu or from COVID or from anything. But this is, I don't see the corpses lying around on the streets. I only know what the mass media tell us. This is the only information I know. If I would not read the mass media, I would not be aware that there is a pandemic. Okay, second question. The question you raised about world government and the U.S. is a very interesting question, and I cannot answer it in a very definite way. I tend to think that there is a conjunction, that there is a cooperation between the largest countries, and this cooperation can be seen in the work of the Security Council. This cooperation goes back to 1990, where all the five permanent members decided together to destroy Iraq and to kill 500,000 children. This was not a decision of the United States alone. It was a decision of the Security Council. So I am a little bit wary to say that the United States is the only villain and that China and Russia are defending the world against the U.S. It is much far more complex, and I think the discussion should be held. I mean, the discussion is very interesting, and I'm very much welcoming this discussion.
Can I make one response, and then we can let it go?
Sure.
Is that okay? I would respond on the issue about deaths of COVID, that I've been looking at that very carefully. I consider myself scientific. I'm not pushing anything or whatever, okay? And one of the things one can look at is the so-called excess deaths, country by country. And excess deaths can indicate to you how many people would normally have died between, let's say, January of 2020 and today, or, you know, whenever the data are available, let's say 2 months ago, compared to how many people are now have died during that same period in the past. And there are a lot of studies. I mean, I think there are scientific ones who have done that. And for example, they found that in Russia, something like three times as many people have died as the government reports as having died from COVID. Same thing is true about China. United States, there's some reports that it's about maybe 30% higher than the actual. United States reports about 600,000, but there's some serious reports that it's more like 900,000. So I will just say it straight. I don't agree at all that COVID is anything like a flu.
Okay, I took notice of what you said.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Paul. All right, and then we have two questions left, and then we'll stop it there. So next is Sherry Jacob. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering if you have been following and are aware of the Corona Committee and the attorney Reiner Fuelmick. Have you been following attorney Fuelmick and what he is doing?
Of course.
Oh, good. Okay, because he has proof positive that maybe the gentleman that spoke right before here, that you, no one can really say I had a family member that died of it exactly because of the PCR test was rigged to produce 97.8% false positives. So therefore, we will never know who died of what, really. And from what I understand, that really no more people died than had died the year before. They were just all relabeled as COVID. And Reiner has proof positive, he says, and he's already filed court. The whole house of cards falls with the PCR test. So,
of course.
You know, that's all. Thank you.
Okay, all set. Okay, and then Carl Gullivan, you have the last question. Go ahead.
Elias, I think you just follow up two questions in a sense.
Who is that?
Carl Gullivan.
Okay.
I asked you the first question, or second, I think. But concerning whether the U.S. is the criminal enemy of the whole world, I think not. I think that control of our government obviously has been seized at key points in history. Especially, there was a coup with the assassination of Kennedy, and we've never recovered from that. I think the same forces still have controlled the U.S. Since then, but arguably even goes back to Wilson's administration. But on a more congenial note, I wanted to ask you about your experience in Iceland. I love the country, and if there's any country in the world I would think would not be wanting to harshly rule over its people, it's Iceland. And I just wanted to ask, how did you end up choosing Iceland to spend, I think, so much of your life? And what prompted you to move back to Germany then, after all the years in Iceland?
Well, I chose Iceland because it just I found it fascinating when I was 19 years old, when I went to the United States. So I flew over Iceland, stayed there for 2 days. I find the atmosphere I liked it somehow. It fascinated me. And in fact, the north countries, Sweden and then Norway and Iceland, fascinated me after I watched the films of Ingmar Bergman, who was a great filmmaker. And I came to Iceland, I liked it. I came back to Iceland and stayed there for some time, met the person who became my wife, and just got settled there because I was in love. I was infatuated in the country and in my first wife. And then, later, my wife, we divorced, and later I was a teacher and musician, and I met my new wife, and then came 9/11, and I began to work with Icelandic young people to reveal the facts on 9/11, and from that point I became very much ostracized in Icelandic society. People didn't want to talk to me, and I couldn't get any coverage in any media. It was very difficult, and it became very difficult during the years. So in 2008, we decided, our family, and my wife and son, we decided to move away.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much for your reply.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, and Elias, we do have one more person wanting to ask a question. Are you up for that?
Yeah,
Okay. Let's do this, the last one. Whoops, I think that was you, Sheila, and I think I just somehow got rid of you.
Yeah, just tell me I can ask my question.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. I'm actually replying to Paul regarding the belief that that we can say that any particular person died of COVID-19. There was a headline in a UK paper, I forget which one it was, that literally said that there was not a single death from the flu this past winter in the UK. Not a single death from the flu. And I don't know what the statistics are in Kenya, but in the United States, I saw that the flu deaths this year were down absolutely an unbelievable amount, 98% decrease in flu deaths this year in the United States. I mean, this is just unbelievable. It's unfathomable. The flu, what happened to the flu? It's just gone, in virtually gone. I mean, and then you have reports from various doctors saying that they were pressured, even to the point of being pressured with losing their medical license, if they did not put COVID-19 down as the cause of death, even if they really believed that the person had died of something else. Like in one case, the person was already in hospice for lung cancer, already dying of lung cancer, when they tested positive for COVID. And so COVID goes on the death certificate because they died with COVID, not of COVID. Another aspect in the United States, at least, is that Medicare gave enormous bonuses to hospitals for putting COVID on the death certificates and of Medicare patients and putting them on ventilators. If somebody died of COVID in a hospital, the hospital got a bonus of $13,000. U.S. dollars, and if they died while on a ventilator, the bonus went up to, I believe, $39,000. So there was a huge incentive on the part of hospitals to put COVID on the death certificates, and doctors were being pressured into it, and the families had a big incentive, at least in the United States, to have COVID be on the death certificate because most of the major health insurance companies were waiving deductibles and copays for COVID illnesses. And if someone had been in the hospital for, say, a week on the ICU and you had a 10% or 20% copay, well, you could be on the hook for $100,000 that you would owe. And so I'm sure the incentive was very strong in the United States, at least, which is where I live and what I'm familiar with, on the part of the families, on the part of the doctors, on the part of the hospitals. They all had an incentive to call something a death by COVID. Now, none of this, of course, is directly applicable to what happened with your family in Kenya, which is very sad. However, I think that when you look, and then there's the whole fact of the PCR test, and that the maker of the PCR test, Kerry Mullis, said it should never be used to diagnose any disease. It was only used to amplify tiny particles that could not otherwise be seen, but he says it should never be used for diagnosis. And he died just before this all started in August of 2019.
May I interrupt?
Yes.
Yes. I would like to bring the discussion back to the original theme, 9/11. 9/11 was, as I said, the biggest propaganda operation, which was then the next one was Corona. Now, let me just tell you how the situation in Germany. A person who is criticizing the Corona methods, regardless of his expertise, even if his word expertise, he is hounded. He is not allowed to be. He is not consulted by the government. He is not interviewed by the mainstream media. And in some cases, for example, one judge, the police even went to his home and raided his home to find any information which might implicate the judge in criticizing the corona measures. We have here, basically in Germany today, a fascist system. It means that you cannot even say your opinion. People are afraid to speak up in this country. People are afraid to speak. I am living in an area where most people tell me I don't dare to speak to my neighbors because they will denounce me as somebody who opposes. We have here basically a situation which resembles the Third Reich in Germany, except that there are no concentration camps, but the activities against dissidents reminds me of McCarthy era. It reminds me of the measures against 9/11 truth people. Very, very similar. The 9/11 truth movement has experienced the censorship. Today we experience in Germany and in many countries the same kind of censorship. It is taboo. You are not allowed to criticize the official measures. You are not allowed. It is extremely dangerous. I don't want to speak about my family, but my own experience is extremely bad. I went to one hotel. I needed to go to a hotel a couple of months ago, and I ordered a hotel room. And when I arrived, the first exclamation I was met was not "Good evening, sir," but "Mask." Mask. Just one word, mask. It was an order by the receptionist. You cannot even come in to the hotel without a mask. I said, I have an exemption. We don't consider that exemption. They are not valid in the hotel. And I just said, I already ordered the room. And they said, no, you have to go out and find yourself another room. I said, no, I'm going to sit here. So they called the police. And the police, three police came and had this discussion with me. And at the end of the day, the police people took me with the police car to find another hotel. Okay, I got a room over the night, but it shows you the hysterical way of people, and there are even one state in Germany who issued formulas for the people to denounce their neighbors, where if they are meeting together three or four people, they could denounce them. I mean, this is absolutely, it's terrible. And if the government has to resort to such measures, it tells you something. I don't think that I have to elaborate about it.
Well, we have some similar stuff going on here. And I also have a medical exemption from wearing a mask, and so I have experienced the same thing repeatedly. As soon as I walk in, there's no greeting. There's just a requirement to put on a mask. And, many people have gotten extremely authoritarian about it. There's a lot of, petty tyrants everywhere who just love being able to tell other people what to do, and they take this as an opportunity to do so.
Yeah. You see, when the other side, let me put it this way. You have two sides who believe, some people believe in the corona is very dangerous and the other one don't. Okay, there are two sides to a dispute. But one side is not ready to discuss it, only the other side. We have exactly the same configuration as with 9/11. Those who are on the official side, they don't want to discuss with the other. We, 9/11 truthers, we always seek to a discussion, a debate on equal level. And the same thing applies with corona. The other side just does not want a discussion. We say, we know the truth and you are just idiots. And this is exactly the same phenomenon as we had with 9/11. And I would like to very much to insist upon it to our friends, Zabenka.
Remka.
Yeah, exactly. To insist that we have not a symmetrical relationship between those who believe in one way and the other. We have no symmetrical. We have one side which imposes its will with police and the other side who are trying to criticize. That's all. So if there would be two sides, equal sides to discuss it, this would be something interesting, and I'd like to see it, but it is not the case.
Okay, thank you, Sheila, and thank you. Now,
sorry, Cheryl. Cheryl, can I just
yes.
can I interrupt for 2 seconds? Sheila,
yes.
If you can hear me, can you call Barry again, because somehow he dropped off your line and he's very anxious to rejoin the call. Could you call him back? Not sure if you're muted now, but
let me see if I can unmute her for a minute.
Well, I actually did call him back after he dropped off, and it just rang and he didn't pick up. Do you want me to try him again?
Yeah, try him again. Yeah, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. Is Mark Crispin Miller coming on?
I don't see him here, so I don't think he's going to show tonight. So,
am I on now or not?
Oh. Yes, hang on a second, Paul. Are you guys all set there?
Okay, so you're going to call him, Sheila?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I will. But I'm just wondering if we're basically wrapping up, are we?
Pretty soon.
I don't think we're going to know for sure
now,
in time.
I'm sorry.
To...
I will call him.
Yeah,
I will hang up and call him back. Okay, bye-bye.
Great, thanks.
Okay,
bye.
Thank you. Okay, so Elias, Paul Zaremko would like to ask a question. I know I told you we were done with questions a few questions ago, but are you open? I know it's 3:30 in the morning there where you are. Are you open for another question?
No problem, because anyhow, I'm already awake, so it's no problem.
Okay. So, Paul, go ahead, please. Thanks.
First of all, both of you misunderstand me. I know what is going on here. I know what is going on with Canada. I mean, the Canadian doctors are totally shut out from questioning the story about using the vaccines. It's even worse in Canada than it is in the United States. I happen to live in Buffalo, New York, where it's a bit better because the we've had one reporter here and some lawyers who've gotten into the courts here and gotten people treated with ivermectin and saved their lives, and it's been a normal, regular story. So it is not 100% shut down here in Buffalo, but of course, mainly it is almost shut down. But nevertheless, I mean, we among ourselves can talk honestly and have differences of opinion and not try and shut my opinion down by overwhelming me with all these sort of small issues. And I have to come back to this misunderstanding about excess deaths. When you measure excess deaths, you don't pay any attention to the cause of the death. You don't care anything about what doctors wrote down. You don't care whether it's mislabeled or not, whether somebody was shot by a gun and labeled as a victim of COVID-19. You simply look at whether the death rates that are occurring this past 18 months are higher and how much higher compared to what they should have been corrected for the age distribution of the population. And it's a normal scientific question that has problems. There's no absolutely certain answers, but you can do it. You can examine other people's research and draw your own conclusions. You do not need to know anything about whether doctors are, whether hospitals are being paid or anything like that. Just the number of people who are dying, and it seems like there is more people dying worldwide than normal and in the United States compared to what even the CDC is telling us. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Elias, did you want to respond to that at all?
I don't want to respond. I just want to agree with what we said, that the number of deaths is an indicator. The number of excess deaths or whatever is really correctly a good indicator. However, if I consider Germany, because I'm focused on the country where I'm living, I could not see any particular variation in the number of total deaths in Germany. It goes up and down according to the years. It is I don't see anything statistically significant in the last year of death.
Actually, that may be correct in Germany. That may be correct. But I was talking about places that I know more about, like Russia, like in the United States, or in India, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with your method.
Okay. By the way, I want to mention one other thing, and that is 2 months ago, this conference call had Merle Hess on. She gave one of the two talks. I watch her blog every other day, every third day. And she rejects anybody who says that COVID is not a very nasty disease. She precisely says we have to at least agree on that, and then we can go on and talk about other things. What does that partly mean? That partly means that people's fear are not just stimulated by the government. There's also something real out there that we have to deal with. There's something, if you want to put it in Marxist terms, there's something material that's going on, not just propaganda.
May I add something?
Yes, of course.
Okay. At the time of 9/11, people said, okay, 9/11 was an inside job and all this terrorism is just a myth. However, we must also consider that terrorism as such is not a myth. It did exist. It does exist. There are people in Palestine who commit terrorism. There are people in Turkey who commit terrorism. So terrorism also is a problem. But it is being exaggerated. And I think personally, and this should be discussed in another setting. I also think that COVID-19 has been exaggerated deliberately by many, many governments in order to pave the way from the new world order. And this can be documented.
I agree.
All right. That sounds like a good note to end on. You're both agreeing. Okay. So thank you, Paul, for your question. And Elias, thank you so much for joining us for the presentation. We really appreciate that and for being flexible and going first. That was really helpful. So I hope you'll join us again sometime. And if you want to stay on the call, right now we just do announcements and anything anyone else wants to say. So you're welcome to stay for that or leave. I know it's late for you, so whatever you choose. All right. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm going to sleep.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Okay. So, all right, that brings us up to our announcements or any topics anyone else wants to discuss. Let me unmute everybody. Let's see. Okay, so does anyone want to make an announcement or discuss anything?
Cheryl, this is Ann.
Okay, Ann, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to let everyone on the call know that I do have some copies of Elias's book, America's Betrayal Confirmed, that was published last July. And I can send you a free copy if you just let me know. My email address is in the minutes at the very end, so just contact me with a mailing address, and I'll send you a free copy. That's all. It's a phenomenal book.
Okay. And Paul, I would like to ask you if you could send us out your articles or research on the excess deaths, because I've read articles that say the opposite, so I would like to see what you have on this kind of confusing topic. So if you could do that, I'd appreciate it.
Speaking.
Okay, anybody else with an announcement or topic they want to discuss?
Yes, who do I contact if I want a free book from what we just heard?
Ann Hendricks, my email is in the minutes at the very bottom of the announcement. You can see my email.
People who aren't talking, mute themselves, please. There's an incredible amount of noise on the line.
Who do I contact for a free copy? What is the person's name?
Okay, it's Ann Hendricks.
Okay,
and did you get an agenda sent to you?
Yes.
Okay, so I think the minutes were attached to that.
Okay.
And you can
thank
see
you.
It there. Okay, thank you. Yep. Okay. All right. So people who are making a little noise, I'm going to mute you if so we can hear. Any other thoughts or comments?
Cheryl?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Carl Golovin. I did want to share something I stumbled across that is really, I find, exceedingly important. It's a translation of part of a book written in Germany in 1915, and it reads as if a script for the entire global leftist agenda even today. And it'll take about 2 minutes to read this excerpt, and I'll then provide a link or a source for it. Would that be okay? Could you silence others so there's not the echo?
Yeah, let me put you in lecture mode, and now I have to unmute you, Carl, so just hang on. Okay, so Carl, yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Now, this is about a two-minute, three-paragraph excerpt from a book written in Germany in 1915, early in World War I, before the Bolshevik Revolution and the Soviet in Russia. And the title of the book it's excerpted from is The Spirit of Militarism. And here's the quote. The historical mission of our world revolution is to rearrange a new culture of humanity to replace the previous social system. This conversion and reorganization of global society requires two essential steps. Firstly, the destruction of the old established order, Secondly, design and imposition of the new order. The first stage requires elimination of all frontier borders, nationhood, and culture, public policy, ethical barriers, and social definitions. Only then can the destroyed old system elements be replaced by the imposed system elements of our new order. The first task of our world revolution is destruction. All social strata and social formations created by traditional society must be annihilated. Individual men and women must be uprooted from their ancestral environment, torn out of their native milieus. No tradition of any type shall be permitted to remain as sacrosanct. Traditional social norms must only be viewed as a disease to be eradicated. The ruling dictum of the new order is nothing is good, so everything must be criticized and abolished. Everything that was must be gone. After destruction of the old order, construction of the new order is a larger and more difficult task. We will have torn out the old limbs from their ancient roots and deep layers. Social norms will be lying disorganized and anarchic, so they must be blocked against new cultural forms and social categories naturally reemerging. The general masses will have been first persuaded to join as equals in the first task of destroying their own traditional society and economic culture. But then the new order must be forcibly established through people again being divided and differentiated only in accordance with the new pyramidal hierarchical system of our imposed global monolithic new world order. End of quote.
All right, Carl, hang on 1 second. I'm going to unmute.
And
I'd really like a copy of that, Carl. That's really incredible.
Well, I'll send a link to Cheryl and Craig. The source of that, well, now there's all sorts of racket. If one were to Google the protocols of, and here's the name, Nahum, N-A-H-U-M, Goldman, G-O-L-D-M-A-N-N. Nahum Goldman, during the most formative years of the 20th century, for over two decades, was president of the World Zionist Organization and the World Jewish Congress. He is an extraordinarily important person in the history of the 20th century. And he wrote this at a very young age, but I think he was conveying a message that's very implicit to the intertwined natures of Zionism and, at the time, Bolshevism and communism. And I think it persists in the left's agenda even today.
Yeah, it's absolutely evident.
That's got nothing to do with Mark.
Okay, so that's all you... Okay.
That's it. I'll provide a link to the article for the minutes.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for sharing that. Okay, anybody else? Oh, go ahead.
One more thing on the topic of COVID, and that is, and to Paul, that I don't deny that people have actually died of COVID-19. I'm one of the people who does believe that it's real, and I actually do know one person tangentially who died of it. He was quite obese. I think he must have been over 300 pounds and not tall. So he clearly had a serious comorbidity there. But I know a lot of people. You know, where I live now, I've lived here for 20 years, and I'm involved in a spiritual group. I'm involved in a political group. I'm on a swimming team. You know, I've got lots of different people I've worked with over the years. I know a lot of people, and I don't, other than that one person, I don't know anybody who's even been sick with it. So I do know lots of people who've suffered from the lockdowns and have lost jobs and have seen their businesses close. And I have two family members who have died in the last year. And I believe that the isolation was a key factor in their deaths, because they were both elderly, but I just suspect, and I can't prove it, that being in an extended lockdown without human contact is just not good for people, and it's taken a tremendous toll on many, many people. And some of my favorite restaurants have closed around here and are not opening back up. So there has been a tremendous toll on humanity from the lockdowns and the closures and the social distancing. And I don't mean to take anything away from the deaths of your brother and sister-in-law, but just to put it into perspective that there's also a huge price that has been paid by all of these fascistic measures that have been taken against the population. Never, I believe, in the history of humanity have we basically imprisoned healthy people, which is what a lockdown really is. And in Canada, it's even worse, where they tell them they can't even leave their house after 8 p.m.
Okay, thanks, Sheila. And I just wanted to add, I know, Paul, you were in favor of masks, it sounds like, and if I've interpreted you wrong, let me know. But there's just a new study that came out, and I'll send it around. I can't remember who did it right now. I think it was a couple countries combined, but showing that the masks don't work at all in preventing the spread of the disease and also can be harmful, and I think we've all seen those other studies about that. So it isn't just an okay thing to require people to wear masks. Mm-hmm. And I know people who have asthma asthma and anxiety who really suffer with masks. So just to throw that out there, and I'll send that latest study out around to everyone. Any other thoughts or comments?
Can I add to that, Cheryl? I cannot comprehend how almost anywhere you would wear a mask that would be healthier than breathing the air. I mean, there was a comment about there are countries, Japan or, different China, wherever, where, you do see people wearing masks and it's been going on for a long time. I still question that, they're told. It simply cannot be any healthier to wear the mask than breathing air freely. It just does not make sense to me.
Yeah, there was just a parents in Florida took their kids' masks after wearing them for like 4 hours. They had washed them. They wore them for 4 hours or something like that, 4 or 5. And then they studied what was in them, and they found all sorts of illnesses, meningitis and pneumonia and a lot of other things. So they're not safe to be doing like that. And I think OSHA used to agree with that, although now they seem to have caved into the propaganda. Anyway, anyone else?
This is Richard. I have a comment that and I don't know if it's been brought up in this forum or not, but there was a study. Well, I wouldn't call it a study, but there was black carbon fibers found not only on the masks, which were mass-produced in China. I just said carbon. I don't know that they're carbon. But there are black fibers that move and respond to temperature and to other stimulus. And these fibers were also found on the test swabs that are put into the back of people's nasal passages next to their brain. And there was an interview done by Dana Ashley on this subject, who has a fairly well-known YouTube video. And she interviewed a gentleman who was deeply investigating this subject, along with another team of his a year ago, and something like half of them were killed, and so he quit, and he was threatened, and they tried to kill him too, and I forget his name. In fact, he may have been anonymous. I'm just bringing that up because we're talking about masks, and the masks themselves are some say part of the global depopulation program, and so I guess I just wanted to throw that in. It's not something that I've studied in any depth at all personally, but I think a conversation that is discussing masks in general, people should be aware of this component of it, and It's only left on YouTube because she was so careful in avoiding all of the words, and she actually bleeped them out and showed them graphically on the YouTube video. And it's still there. It was made in 2020, and maybe somebody could send a link if you happen to know a particular interview I'm talking about to Cheryl so that you can reference this. That's all.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. That's interesting. I'd like to see that.
Richard, do you know the name of the interview? I'm familiar with Dana Ashley. I mean, do you know the name of the YouTube so we could locate it?
I'd have to just search her on YouTube and find it, which I'm going to try to do right now. But I was hoping somebody else would have more ready access to it.
It's just, it can be hard when you look at a video that, you know, the names don't necessarily correspond with the content. It can be difficult unless you have a link, you know, to find the right video. But if you've watched,
well, the interesting thing about that particular video is also he actually did a lot of research on how to combat. Well, I'll just mention that what she says or what he said is that these fibers actually do coalesce inside your body, and they it's the crystalline. Their crystalline structure actually forms itself when it hits the hydrochloric acid in your stomach. Now, so coming back to me now, and what he was saying is that we breathe this stuff in from the geoengineering that's going on up there, and it attacks the lungs first. And that causes people to cough up, and then they swallow the phlegm, and thereby swallowing these fibers. There's two ways, then, obviously, that you're saying that they get into your body. One, through the masks and the testing, which is the real reason why they're trying to, well, one of the real reasons they're trying to test everybody.
So let me ask
mandatory
why.
Testing. But then, hold on a second. And then also through breathing it this in from the fibers are released along with the barium and other strontium and the aluminum that's coming down from above. So the point there is that these are forming, he says, nanobots in the body, which is very, very interesting, scary. And he says the solution to this is taking apple cider vinegar in three doses per day, three tablespoons per glass, and then a little pinch of boron, which is borax, which is, yes, the detergent from the grocery store, just a pinch. Any more than that can be toxic. So anyway, that's what was of greatest interest to me, how to protect my body from this stuff if it's, you know, as real as he claimed and his studies showed that it was. Go ahead.
So I just want to comment that the reason why Japanese have worn masks for years is not to spread contagious diseases among themselves, either inside or outside, as they're on a subway or whatever, okay? They've been doing that for years. It's not a big deal.
But the problem, Paul, is that what they say is that it's like driving.
Let me finish.
Go ahead, Paul. Sorry. Go ahead.
If those Japanese have been wearing masks for years, you would expect their death rate to not be they have the longest longevity in the world. not the shortest. I mean, they're way ahead of us in terms of longevity. So unless you think the masks are being manufactured in a different way than they were before, but then you have to get into that topic, which we're really going very far in these speculations here. But one other comment, and that is, I've lived long enough that I can find on the internet almost anything as a confirmation bias. I can find almost anything I want, which confirms what I already feel before I went on the internet. And one of the things I've done is I'm a left person, but I listen to the people on the right, and I sometimes accept people. I mean, I try to be scientific and not try and let my biases, I try not to look for confirmations. That's all I want to, I don't know what else to say. I think it's going too far, but.
I think it's a fascinating conversation. And if you look at the size of what they say is a virus, and you look at the hole that it can go through in the mask, you realize it. That it's
in a moisture. The virus goes in a moisture. It isn't by itself floating in the air.
Okay, I can't comment on that. Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay, I think what, if I could just jump in here, I think what Richard is saying is that the viruses, you know, whether they're in moisture or they're too small to get through the mask, they're too tiny and the mask can't block them. And I think there's doctors who have showed that. If you go to YouTube, there's a Dr. Ted Noel who does experiments with the masks with smoke, and smoke is larger than the viruses, and they all get out. And then the recent study that I just saw said they did a study and there was no difference between people wearing masks and people not wearing masks in disease transmission. So, and again, I all find that and send that. So, anybody else?
There also have been people who have died in China from running with masks on. I read about 5 boys died in a gym class because they were forced to run while wearing masks. And so trying to exercise when you don't get sufficient oxygen is just plain not good for you. I personally thought the whole thing was bullshit right from the beginning. I had maybe 1 week where I thought it was dangerous, and by the end of March of 2020, I knew we were being propagandized. And so I've never done any of these things. I've never used a single drop of hand sanitizer. I've avoided wearing a mask except if it was absolutely required, such as in a place like a hospital. And I've never social distanced. I've had parties. I've gone everywhere I wanted to go. I've never had a single. I've never. You know, when I go to the grocery store and I try to take any grocery cart that's there. They'll say, "Oh, ma'am, you can't take that one. That one hasn't been sanitized." I'll say, "I'd rather have the one that doesn't have all the carcinogenic goop all over it." And I think it's good for the immune system to be challenged a little bit. So, you know, I take the unsanitized cart, and I mean, all I can say is nothing's happened to me, and I don't know a single person who's even been ill. I do know the one person who got ill and died. But if we actually were in a pandemic, we wouldn't need a marketing campaign to convince us of it. We would all know friends and family members had been sick and had died, and I don't.
Okay, my wife has a relative in Germany. She's Polish, but an immigrant to Germany, living in Germany. He had almost identical statements that you just made. His whole family got COVID, and he died. And now his wife is totally reversed on the whole issue about COVID and goes totally the government line. I'm not saying that that's the right response, but I'm saying that he was wrong in the first place to underestimate COVID. And I think
How do we know they had COVID?
Never mind.
Well, I'm asking, how do we know that?
Doctors. I say never mind. If we're getting to that point that you're questioning the doctor's evaluation that all of them got COVID, well, I don't know what to say.
Well, Paul, you heard what I said about how the doctors in this country anyway have been pressured to the point of Dr. Scott Jensen, who's now running for governor in Minnesota.
His family believes it.
He was a state senator. I believe he's running for governor in Minnesota. He has had his medical license threatened three times after 38 uneventful years as a family doctor in Minneapolis because of him speaking out about the pressure to put COVID on death certificates. And he was very clear that the direction is that if there is any chance at all it could be COVID, you must put COVID on the death certificate. They're basically preempting their medical knowledge when they know that somebody really died of something else.
I know this.
This is Dan. I have a question slightly different.
Go ahead, Ian.
There is some talk that the virus was released accidentally in Wuhan. And even Rainer Fielmick has put that in his reports and interviews. And I wonder, it just doesn't seem like anything was accidental about it to me. What do you all think about that? Why is that becoming part of the narrative in some cases?
Well, to make the whole thing seem more legitimate than it really is, and to make it, they would rather have us believe that it's accidental. You know about Event 201, which took place, I think, October of 2019, where they role played out this whole thing. You know, they do this. They do drills, the drills that go live, and
right.
they role played out having a SARS-CoV worldwide pandemic. And it seems that they were hoping for many more deaths than they got. So it makes me think maybe Fauci should ask for a refund when since tried to get them to do gain-of-function research. They didn't gain a whole lot of function. But they got something that was maybe contagious, but just not very deadly. What I read something today said that if for a person who's under the age of 60 and, I believe it was under the age of 40, and with normal weight, the chance of death from COVID is 1 in 100,000.
Yeah. Well, what surprised me is Rainer Fielmick saying that the German Corona Investigative Committee has added that to their interviews, to their talks, that they are agreeing that whoever they've spoken to, they believe that it was released accidentally, and he goes into that a little bit. I have a hard time believing that's the case. I wouldn't know, but
I agree with you, Anne. I don't. That doesn't. Yeah.
Have you heard that also, Cheryl?
Yes, I've heard that. I don't agree with that either. And why it's becoming more in the media right now. I don't know. There's got to be something behind that maybe we want to attack China or something. I don't know.
Well, Rainer Fulmick is, I'm sure, a very intelligent man, but it doesn't mean he's perfect. You know, maybe he's making a mistake in this one area. Mm-hmm. There was something that was circulating recently that the people that were in my group believed that it was credible because it had come from Niels Harrit. I don't believe it was credible. It didn't have anything to do with 9/11. It had to do with this COVIDiocy thing. But I don't believe it's credible. I traced it back to its source, and even at the source, they were not sure that it was credible. So just because someone who we respect sends something around, I think we still have to do our own research and see if they actually, are correct.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
By the way, Rainer Fulmick will be one of the speakers on September 11th this year.
Mm-hmm.
Sponsored by, at an event, an all-day event, sponsored by Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. And there'll be several other very interesting speakers there. Actually, I'll be one of them. But,
where do you know where is that going to be, Richard?
That will be at the All Souls Church. And this is just kind of
that New York?
Now. Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
In the upper, it's like 80th Street or something. And we will also have an event after that in the evening where we will show a new film that we're working on with Dylan Avery about the family members' quest for justice after 20 years. And that film will be shown, and they'll be backed up by the experts. So that's also at the same location.
Excellent. Oh, that's great. Yeah, Richard, I think if you don't mind me giving a plug for you, AE has a fundraiser going on that ends at midnight tonight. Is that correct? For the film?
Yes, That very film, yes. That's the one that I was
talking about. Yeah. If anyone wants to help him out. Okay.
Dylan Avery did a great job with Seven. I loved it.
Richard,
I have a question. This is Ann. Do you have a? Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi.
Okay. I just skimmed those emails about the film. Sorry, but you are working with some of the victims, the family members, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to mention to you. I joined Friends of Flight 93 Memorial a couple of years ago, so I watched their speakers, and many of the people who were either family members of Flight 93 passengers or involved that day in Shanksville, they speak, and it's quite interesting. And there was just a talk by Jack Grandkolis, whose wife died on that plane, and he does not know. He obviously does not know. If there is any way that you can think of sometime how to reach these people, because I want to write to him. I'm in contact with the people, the Friends of Flight 93, and they don't know yet that I'm a truther. I just ask a lot of questions and get information from them. For instance, last August, Tony James, who was the FAA officer in charge there at the Shanksville site, he said I could ask him any questions, and I just wasn't ready to do that because he's lied about so much. But I do outreach to those people involved out there in Shanksville, and if you can think of how to get in touch with someone like Jack Grandkolis out in California or other people who know addresses, I send books and things to them and information.
I'm not sure what you're asking, Anne. If you're in touch with them, if you can get their emails, I'll be happy to email them something.
Oh, well, I'll do that too. Okay.
Yeah. Just send that stuff to me.
Sure.
I mean, those contact infos. And,
sure.
I'll reach out.
I'll do that too. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other thoughts, comments, announcements? Okay, so I'm hoping we can get Mark Kristen Miller to join us then. I'm not sure why he didn't make it tonight. He seemed pretty enthusiastic the last email I got from him about joining us tonight. So I'll keep you posted on that. And if you have any other ideas for speakers next in July, please let us know. Email either Craig, myself, or Ann and let us know. And that'd be great. Thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for being there, Cheryl.
Cheryl, for your hard work.
You're welcome. Mom.
Thanks for your help.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Sheila, if you could hear me. Yeah.
I can hear you, and I think they can hear you too, Barry.
Okay. So,
hi,
good night,
Barry.
Everyone. Yeah, hi and bye.
Okay. All right. Bye, everyone.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.